Prayer.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about addiction, alcoholism, the big book, the 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all of these things to help me see the truth. Amen.
All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome back. Welcome to the new arrivals that have joined us. Those are those of you that are in this program and those of you who are get to come and go as you will today. I want to start by reading something. It's called Opportunity. A green bird darting in the night. Will you be able to see it? Will you be able to catch it? Cling to spirit like a shadow. Move without a shadow. Times of oppression and adversity cannot last forever. How is the transition made to new and better situations? In the midst of great difficulty, a tiny opportunity will open, if only by chance. You must be sharp enough to discern it, quick enough to catch it, and determined enough to do something with it. If you let it pass, you will be filled with regrets. Stick to spirit like shadow. Wherever it goes, you go. As soon as it throws something your way, catch it by sheer reflex. It is like the bird. If you try to catch it, you will miss. If you are always with it, moving at its speed, as much a part of it as its own shadow, then it is easy to seize it. When you act, however, you in turn must have no shadow. In other words, what you do must leave no messiness. No leftover consequences. Nothing that will haunt you later. That is one of the ways in which you avoid creating more bad situations for yourself. Your every movement is traceless. And so the reason I read this is I think we can lay this against the early recovery. All of you are in a position right now with an opportunity. So opportunity has to meet initiative. And in order to be successful, it's, you know, like the old Latin saying, carpe diem. Carpe diem. You know, I've watched a lot of people die over the last several years. I mean, the entire time I've been here. It just seems like it's been kicked up here over the last few months. And all of them have had the same opportunities, and for whatever reason, their paths led to a different place. I don't know where your path leads. I do know you have an opportunity right now. And each individual sitting in this room has experienced a miracle, whether you believe it or not. There are two miracles that have to happen in order for transformation to take place. And the first miracle is separation from that substance that is killing you. It could be alcohol, cocaine, heroin, whatever it is. And it has to happen quickly. Otherwise, we'd have no story, no chance, no opportunity. The second miracle is one that takes place over a course of time. And it is the duration, the length of that time is different for each individual. And that's the returning sanity, where we don't attempt a desperate experiment of the first drink, and we don't require an anesthetic to deal with the psychically painful experience of life. Because at the end of the day, that was one of the dominating reasons of why I began to use alcohol and drugs as an anesthetic. The way I was experiencing life was psychologically painful. And then I discovered an anesthetic. And it started with weed and alcohol, and then it just kept progressing from there. And each time, I was increasing the amount of freedom I was experiencing in life as I added these substances. But because there's an evolution to our relationship, every relationship has an evolution. So does our relationship with drugs and alcohol. And as that evolved, I began to experience consequences and what alcohol and drugs were doing for me in the past. Now it flipped, like Bill Wilson talks about in his story. The weapon that he had forged had turned forged into a boomerang, all but turned and cut him to ribbons. Because I forged a weapon, alcohol, cocaine, I used to sling a lot of drugs, and I liked going to concerts, and that gave me a sense of wholeness and validation and self-worth, and it was the weapon that I forged, and it all returned and all like a boomerang and cut me to ribbons. And so then I found myself where you find yourself right now, at a turning point. And the turning point has to be rooted in genuine surrender. But for many alcoholics and addicts, they experience remorse, morbid reflection, guilt. They think that they're guilty of doing things that they believe are wrong. And then shame, which is believing that there's really something wrong with you internally. Like, I am different. I'm set apart as a distinct entity. There is something awful about me. And so there is a section in the doctor's opinion, and the way it's worded in the doctor's opinion, it says the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol and drugs is interesting. And especially as lay people, we're not professionals. But if we really take a hard look at this phenomenon of craving, we will find that it accounts for many things that we could not otherwise explain. And so let me get by a show of hands. How many people in here, under the influence, you've been on a 2-3-4 day bender, and you hurt someone you care about in order to keep that run going? Who in here is guilty of that? All right, let the record show about 80-85% of the room has raised their hand. And as I looked back into that, when I was doing counseling and therapy and you know, the programs before I actually worked the steps, I had a tremendous amount of all of those things I threw out at you, the guilt, the shame, the morbid reflection. I'm such a piece of, you know, shit, like, what is wrong with me? How I'm such a poor choice maker. And there was one incident, and I like to tell stories. I was on a 4 or 5 day run, and I'm gonna give you the Reader's Digest version of this story right now. And I'm walking out of my house to get in the car to go back downtown. And my mom has blocked me in the driveway. And I look like I've been up for 4 or 5 days, you know. And literally, I had walked out. There was a deck on the front of my house. I walked out, and I saw that she had, like, blocked the driveway. And I ran back in the house to tell my girlfriend my mom was here, because we were tweaking hard, and we were haggard. And my mom comes into the house, and you know, she looks at me with this horrified look on her face, and we start going at it. And I said and did some things that I carried a great deal of guilt and shame. You know, I called my mom the C word. You guys know what C word I'm talking about, to her face. I called her the B word. And I kicked her out of my house, and she wouldn't leave. And I went around the corner, and I grabbed this Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner, those handheld vacuum cleaners, and I came back out, and I threw it at her head. And, you know, thank God she ducked, and the thing shattered on the wall. And, like, she thought she'd seen a monster. And she had. She was, like, witnessing a monster at this point. And, you know, and I yelled and I screamed and she left and I waited for her to leave and I went downtown. And we didn't talk for a while after that incident. But I remember being in counseling a few times where we would try to do a process group around that event. And I never understood why I was capable of doing something like that. And then I remember going through the steps and we get to the doctor's opinion about the physical craving, the phenomenon of craving. Explains many things we cannot account for. So, if you stay on the spiritual path, you will discover that every statement available to us in existence is true from one's perspective, and if you look at it from different points of view, you will find that it's not true. It's a paradox. And I do want to use that concept to apply right now to what I'm talking about. Because when a man told me, or he asked me actually, what does it mean to be powerless? And I said, you know, to not have power. Okay. He said, when you're powerless over alcohol and drugs, does that mean that they have power over you? And I said, yeah, of course it does. And he said, do you think it's like a compulsion, like you're being compelled to go down a road you don't want to go down to? And I was like, yeah, that's how I've experienced my addiction. Like this thing in me doesn't want to do what I'm about to do, but I do it anyway. And he said, well, the way you just described it, does that sound like you have a choice? And I said, no. And he said, okay. He said, look, when you're under the influence, like the phenomenon of craving has activated, you're not using or drinking to overcome, to escape. You're using and drinking to overcome a craving beyond your mental control. You've been removed from the equation. He said, and what we do under the compulsion is we hurt people that get in the way of that. And you're not responsible for any of those things that you did. But he said this is a paradox. He followed that up by saying, and you're 100% responsible for everything you did. Now, you know, I'm like, well, how can you like be responsible and not be responsible? He says, welcome to the spiritual realm. Right? This is what we're talking about here. How does this work? So for my own benefit, for my own, because this is one of the things that alcoholics, one of the many things that alcoholics and addicts have there that's trying to kill them is this guilt and shame. And we need to get free of it. And so when I internalized this idea and looked at my own experience and it abundantly confirmed to me that I was under a force that was moving me, part of what makes us alcoholics and addicts, I said, oh my God, like when I'm in that state, I have no control. And he said, yes. He said, but when you go make amends to your mom, she doesn't want to hear any of that shit. She doesn't want to hear about phenomenon of craving. She doesn't want to hear that you suffer from an allergy beyond your mental control. She wants to hear that you regret what you did, that you'll do anything to make it right, that you'll give her an opportunity to tell you how it made her feel. And then you will do everything she wants you to do to make things right. So when I went to make amends to my mother, remind her that I called her the C word and the B word. And what I said is I did things that no son should ever do to a mother. I said things that no son should ever do to a mother. I disrespected you as a woman. And I regret that. And I want to know what I can do to make things right between us. I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to never be capable of those things. That's what the doctor means in my interpretation of it, of the allergy explaining many things we could not account for. But over the years, I have worked with many alcoholics and addicts on this idea, and they just can't seem to understand it. That's what true. If you don't have power, by default, something else has power over you. And that's what we're talking about in this problem here. It's like when how many of you sitting in this room had an important engagement that you had to be at, and you picked up a drink or a drug a day or so before that important engagement was to be settled, going to work on time and showing up and earning that paycheck? That's an event that's going to take place, and it's going to be settled favorably in your favor. You know, having birthday parties, family events, gatherings with friends, weddings you're supposed to participate in. I use that because that's in my experience, and you don't show up. So I remember all of these experiences had some version of what I'm about to explain to you. I decide I need to start getting high. And it is way before I need to be somewhere. And let's say I start early on a Saturday morning because I've continued my run from Friday night. This happened to me many times. And I had to be at a dinner at 6 p.m., right? I look over at my clock at like 10, and I'm like, no, I don't need to stop right now. I can keep going. So I look back at my clock around 12, and I'm out. And I'm like, no, I can go downtown and get $100. I'll be good. It's 6 o'clock. Get back to my house around 1. I look over at the clock. It's 2. I'll get in the shower. Get my clock. It's 4 o'clock. I got to be where I got to go at 6 o'clock. 30 more minutes. Then I look at the clock and it's 6:30. And then my phone starts blowing up. And I turn my phone off. I don't show up where I'm supposed to be at. For years, I carried a tremendous amount of guilt and shame because I thought every time I looked at the clock, I changed my mind. So I was exerting some form of mental control. But when this man introduced me to the idea of the phenomenon of craving, he's like, Terry, you didn't change your mind every time. He goes, you were under the compulsion, the phenomenon of craving. You were using to overcome a craving beyond your mental control. Does this make sense? You guys, like, you have this can only, you know, I'm telling you stories out of my own experience right now, which will get you to remember or recollect your own experiences, but it's only until you dig into your experience and you find that story will you then validate it for yourself. My experience will only take you so far. And so as I discovered all of these things, what kept happening to me is I kept saying to myself, I don't ever want to be under the compulsion of something where I do things like this. So that again is wrapped up with the concept I mentioned last night of lack of power. That is our dilemma, right? The lack of power being our dilemma is going to protect us from the actual mental component, which protects us from the physical component that I'm talking about right now. I don't want to be in a position where I can do that to people. But what happened when somebody described it to me like that, what I was able to do was get free of the guilt and the shame and the remorse. I sponsored a guy off and on for years. He lost custody of his 3 kids. He lost his marriage. He lost his, I don't know, very expensive home, lost his business, picked him up from detox. He's sitting in the front seat of my car, and he's like, I can't believe I keep choosing crack over my kids. And I think he's looking at a picture of one of his kids. And I remember looking over at him. I'm like, you have never understood what it means to be truly powerless. I'm like, when you go on these runs and you disappear and you don't show up, do you think you're sitting in that hotel room just choosing this over and over and over? And like, it just didn't register with him. But the amount of guilt and shame that he has around that is so stark, and it's palpable. Like, I can feel it coming out of him. And it saddens my heart to see it and to witness it. And all I can do up here is sort of, you know, share this experience, identify the concept, and then you guys got to overlay the two and see if it's validated in your experience. Because if you continue to believe that you can, you have that you make all these bad choices, then you're not really. Well, why admit powerlessness then? If you admit being powerless, you can't turn around and say you have a choice. If you lose power, you lose choice, you lose control, you lose all three. It's not one or the other, or one out of three, or two out of three. And I want to read something real quick. This is a book written by an AA historian. His name is Ernest Kurtz. Our darkness, our shortcomings, our doubts is a thirst. A thirst for power, a thirst for God, for the spiritual, for whatever might alleviate this painful side of the human condition. For whatever might somehow fill the empty hole in our human being, we seek help for what we cannot face or accomplish alone. In seeking help, we accept and admit our own powerlessness. And in that acceptance and admission and surrender and the acknowledgement that we are not in control, spirituality is born. Spirituality begins in suffering, because to suffer means to undergo. And the essence of struggling and suffering lies in the reality that it is undergone. That it has to do with not being in control, that it must be endured. We may endure patiently or impatiently, but because we are human beings, because we are not at each and every moment in ultimate control, we will suffer. A spirituality of imperfection is always mindful of the inevitability of struggling. The first work of grace is simply to enable us to begin to understand what is wrong. And one of the first things that is wrong is that we are not in control. We do not have all the answers. The reality of that lack of control, the sheer truth of our powerlessness in the face of it, makes available the fundamental spiritual insight that insists on the necessity of an emptying out. Expressed in modern vocabulary, this points to the need for surrender, or the language of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is hitting bottom. This process of emptying out, surrendering, or hitting bottom comes from the realization that on so many different levels we are powerless and we are lost. That's where we are when we're sitting in a place like the Bridges of Hope. There are so many things here. There's hope and there's hopelessness. Which one do you think is better for you right now? Anybody want to take a stab at that question? What if I were to tell you hopelessness is better than hope right now? Another paradox. The more hopeless you are when you get here, the greater hope there is for your recovery. Because when you're entirely hopeless, you've given up on trying to fix yourself. You've given up on you having the answers, and you're more likely to follow the guidelines and directions of a competent sponsor. So the first half of the first step is to see this powerlessness. Not only after we start, like I've focused on this morning, but before we ever start, we're also powerless, because we'll always go back unless we're in fit spiritual condition, and that somehow provides a safety and a protection that you will not understand experientially until you have worked the steps and experienced the 10-step promises. But this begs a question that I'm going to touch on here briefly as I turn it over to Brandon. The question being, what is the breeding ground for my mind to start to tell me that I have to have an anesthetic to cope with life? Because in a lot of times when we go to meetings, the focus on the meetings is work these steps and get rid of the mental obsession. The steps are designed to treat something other. They're not designed to treat the mental obsession. They're not designed so we learn how not to drink or use. The steps are designed so we can tap an unsuspecting inner resource that many of our members identify with their conception of God. What does that look like? The normal state of being for an alcoholic or addict, for most, is uneasy or restless, discontented or not satisfied, and easily annoyed or irritable. In the meetings, we hear that all the time: restless, irritable, discontent. I like the words uneasy, easily annoyed, and not satisfied. I'm bored. My life has no meaning. I can't sit still. I gotta go. There's a spring in my chest, and it tightens, and it tightens, and it tightens to the point where it must be relieved. And my past tells me that alcohol and drugs provide that relief, but my mind conveniently forgets that once I put alcohol and drugs in my body, I will not be able to control how much. That's the way the alcoholic cycle works, right? But it all starts with an internal condition. That's our major trigger, right? That is the trigger, the internal condition. Doesn't matter if I surround myself with, you know, the winners. It doesn't matter if I stay away from that part of town. It doesn't matter if I stay away from stressful situations. You know, I can practice all the gratitude, serenity, perseverance, hope, all those one-word principles that are behind the steps. Right? I can work on those promises coming true. And typically when I do that, I forget about working the steps. I can focus on all those things, but the needed power is not there. I have to go deeper because the steps are designed so the personal relationships in my life begin to change. I'm not constantly taking. I begin to give more than I take. The amount of judgment that I experience starts to go down. My emotional natures, they don't level out immediately, but I gain a new level of awareness about like how emotionally unstable I can be, how I can go from being in a good mood to being angry. The big book says, you know, unable to control our emotional natures is part of this problem. You know, I won't be full of misery and depression for extended periods of time because I have a program in place that helps me talk to people and disclose this stuff about myself, and I work with others and I sacrifice and I feel like I have a purpose and I don't feel useless, which is another. Feeling useless is a part of that internal condition. Being full of fear, being unhappy, being unable to help other people. This is the internal condition. The big book calls those things the bedevilments. And what the bedevilments are, the bedevilments, this is from page 52, are manifestations of the spiritual malady. The spiritual malady that we have is conscious separation. We don't connect. We feel isolated. Alcohol and drugs provided connection for us for many years, and now they don't. Now they actually do the exact opposite. But remember, the mind tells us that I can get back to that place where they were doing a lot of things. Drugs and alcohol did a lot for me. They would never have done so much to me if at one point they had not done a tremendous amount for me. And so the 12-step process is designed to treat that internal condition. That is what we're up against here. We have to be inwardly reorganized. That's how Bill Wilson describes Evie Thatcher. His roots grasp new soil. He had that starry look in his eyes. He was fresh-skinned and glowing. Those are the words that Bill Wilson uses to describe Evie. Something has been transformed. And if you want to be free of the bondage of self and the bondage of drugs and alcohol, an inward transformation must take place. And when the inward transformation takes place, if and when you start having trouble in personal relationships, or you can't control your emotional natures, or you're full of fear, misery, depression, you feel useless, your default position will be to go to God. Because those things will actually create a need for God. That's what will change. You'll have a need to use prayer as a tool to solve all your problems. You will be able to use meditation as a tool to address all your problems. Service to others will be a tool to address all your problems. Accountability and intimate self-disclosure will be a tool to solve all your problems. Inventory will be a tool to solve all your problems. This is what this way of life is about. There was one other thing I wanted. Oh man, I can't stand it when I do that. All right, I'll remember this. I'm going to turn it over to Brandon. Save your questions for the end. We'll come back at the end and see if there are any questions on any of that. And you're off.
I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Brandon.
Brandon.
And to update you on the timeline of what was going on 10 years ago, just for fun, and for those of you who were not here last night, the experience of God striking Brandon sober occurred around 10 years ago, these next several days. And today, May the 12th, was the day that we got up at 5 in the morning and we started putting the final packing duties into the vehicle. And probably somewhere around 6, we probably intended to leave at 6, we probably rolled out around 6:30. And then we went over and met my in-laws at their house, and then we hit the road. And so right now we're somewhere on I-16, headed out to that island with no bridge where the horrific experience of me being struck sober happened. So I hear a lot of people talk about in meetings that these principles or ideas behind the steps, and that there's the first step opens you up to the hope that there's a possibility. Okay. It is my experience that if you are really connected with your first step, I think he's got his headphones on. If you're really connected with your first step, what you realize is you are absolutely 100% totally fucked. And that if you look at your experience, everything confirms that this time it's going to be just like the last time. And the next time is too. And that you can go to treatment, you can do these things, but guess what? You're fucked. You're going to drink again. You're going to use again. If you get totally in touch with the first step, that's what the first step tells you. Is there is nothing you can do at all ever by yourself to stay clean and sober, period. Fucked. Okay? I'm going to read a couple things. We'll see where this goes. Trust. Patience and trust go hand in hand. We often hear that there are no mistakes, no coincidences ever. We are told that all past events, all past, present, and future serve a purpose. Some experiences eventually fit comfortably into the paradigm. A relationship that abruptly ended or a missed promotion undoubtedly closed doors that needed to be closed. In time, we could see that. But the experience of physical violence or devastation of natural disaster aren't easily accepted. And when we're worrying about a new job or medical test results, it's hard to be peaceful and patient. At these times, we have to help one another remember that we are always getting just what we need when we need it. Perhaps we can't agree that we needed the abuse or the tornado's destruction, but we did learn important lessons from the experience. Lessons that we'll likely be called on to share with others. Remember, we're here to teach and learn. We won't always recognize one from the other. My trust in the Holy Spirit lets me be patient today. Nothing will happen for which I'm not prepared. Okay? In the big book, see if this sounds similar, says Henry Ford once made the wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is only true if one is willing to turn the past into good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The Alcoholic our addict's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one. Okay? Getting in touch with your powerlessness and having this idea and understanding that maybe it's happening for some reason. Okay, I subscribe to a belief that there is no failure, ever. Simply feedback. Okay, one of the greatest failures in the history of the United States was this guy named Thomas Edison. Don't know if you've ever heard of him. He perfected the light bulb. He started a company called General Electric, which for much of my lifetime was the most... It was worth the most out of any company in the world. Okay, greatest failure in the history of this country, in my opinion. They say it took him 10,000 attempts to perfect the incandescent light bulb. And you know what he would say every time he failed? That's one more way that didn't work. I just need to find the way that will. 10,000 times. Patience. Trust. I'm doing this for a reason. What is it? But the only way that that works is if you're open to the possibility that what you've gone through has a purpose. Okay? So, get this. I believe that all of us in this room could have gotten well a long, long time ago. But the set of experiences necessary wasn't great enough. We had to learn to our innermost self this thing, powerlessness, right? We had to really get down with the fact that everything I tried failed. Everything. Including treatment, including going to AA, including maybe working some of the steps, including doing what Tarek and Brandon said I should do, and I failed. Because you're missing something. There's something within you in your powerlessness that you're not connecting with that only a spiritual solution will solve. So the first step's bad news. It's all bad news. When we start getting into the second step, that's when things start to change. Because I start to realize that, okay, perhaps the way that I've been doing it doesn't work. And that I need to seek something else. Okay? So, there's a thing in the Nine Set Promises that I didn't believe. I didn't. It was great. It sounded cool. The part of it where it says, we will see how our experience can benefit others. Cool. I can't get down with that, right? I'm about 6 months sober, and I hear that read at meetings over and over and over again. Yeah, the rest of it sounds fluffy and cool. I like it. But my experience, no. That can't help anybody. And so I get a... For some reason, I don't go to this weekend workshop that I really wanted to go to. And I'm back in Atlanta for some reason. I think that I'm supposed to go on a date with this girl, but I haven't even arranged that. So I'm literally just completely free and open. And I get a text message that the guy is staying at the La Quinta, and he's run out of money, and he needs a place to stay for the weekend until he can get into sober living. And he's dry at the moment, and he's done, and he just doesn't want to keep going. And I happen to be free. So I go and pick this guy up, and I don't know what I'm doing. I call a bunch of people. I text a bunch of people trying to figure out, you know, how am I supposed to 12-step a guy for a weekend? And so he gets in the car, and I just start telling him my story. I think this is what I'm supposed to do. So I tell him about the wife that kicked me out, the two kids that I hardly get to see, the 8 jobs in 6 years, the multiple foreclosures for the failed business that I have, the bankruptcy, all this stuff. that just, it just sucks. And it really kind of hurts the way that I feel about myself, right? And so I'm sitting there and I'm telling this guy this story. And I got a pretty nice car at that time because material stuff was still pretty important to me. And he's sitting in the front seat. And as I'm telling him the story, he keeps leaning over farther and farther. And I'm like, oh, man, he's going to get sick all over my fucking floor. But I just keep talking, keep telling him my story. And I finish. I said, I guess now just tell me yours. And he says, I don't need to tell you. You just told it to me. I had a gift. At 6 months sober that most people do not ever get. Is God put this guy in my life that literally had my same story. Two kids. His were daughters. I have a daughter and a son. Wife that kicked him out. Failed business. He was a successful man that burned it all down. He was living in a hotel. I was living in my parents' basement. I mean, I could see how my experience could benefit others. That's what gave me hope. The thing that gave me hope was this idea that maybe God does have a plan. Okay? So Tarek talked about the bedevilments, right? And talked about the powerlessness that we get to embrace around the fact that we were having trouble in personal relationships. We were having trouble controlling our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. Right? Couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Had a feeling of uselessness. Right? Anybody in here got any of that? Okay. How about this? Who in here drank or used when they had a girlfriend or significant other? Who in here drank or used when they didn't have a girlfriend? Who in here drank or used when they had a job? When they didn't have a job? When they had a car? Didn't have a car. What are some others? What are all the reasons that people tell you is the reason they drank? Who in here drank because they were abused? Who in here drank because they didn't get abused? Right? None of those are reasons why you drank or used. None of them. It's the powerlessness. It's getting in touch with the powerlessness. Now, just for fun, I'm going to see if this actually works. You know, they say when you're sitting in front of the room, don't ever do an experiment that you don't know how it's going to turn out. We'll find out. Okay. Second step, defects. Six-step list. Or second time through the steps. This is my list of defects that came as a result of inventory. Demanding nature. Need to control. Idea that others' behaviors define me. My validation comes from others' behaviors. The idea that I always do my best. The idea that I know what's best for others. Do I want what I have is a question. Money equals value equals happiness. Laziness. Respecting authority. Okay, well, I'll tell you, some of those still exist because I still have a demanding nature and a need for control. The good news is God is using that to the benefit of all of you this weekend. My validation comes from others' behavior. That still shows up as a defect. I get to watch you guys interact with me and find out, am I doing good or not? But see, what when I know this, I'm getting in touch with my powerlessness now, right? Is that I can work on this stuff all I want, and I can't do anything about it. So just for fun, we'll look at what happened when I went through the steps for the third time. This is about 4.5 years sober. People's behaviors are reflective on me. Wait a second. That was there 1.5 years prior. I demand respect. My path is the best. Money equals security. Oh, this is a new one. This one showed up. I want to be somebody in AA. God's using it. I deserve whatever. I don't trust the process I cannot control. That one seems to be lessening by the fact that I'm just going through this on a whim, right? Okay, so here's another one. I don't know when this one was. It's not dated, but people must act the way I want or think is appropriate. Well, shit, that's still here. Sponsees held to the highest standard, held to a higher standard than me. Ooh. Not sensitive to how my actions affect others. Control issues, sense of entitlement. Here's another one. Don't know when this one's from. I think I'm the greatest. The status of greatness makes me less approachable. Others' action recovery is a reflection on me. Shit, look at this. My point in reading you all this is not to make myself look bad. My point in reading these is that this is powerlessness at various stages throughout my sobriety. Now, what changes as you do this process is your awareness of the things that you're powerless over becomes greater. And when I start to want to control things, there's another voice in my head that says, here you go again, trying to take charge. Every year, I don't know if you know this, every year that we come here as a submission to self, I drive 8,000 to 10,000 miles a month for my job, okay? I'm a badass driver. Like, I know how to navigate stuff and do stuff. I know how to sit and drive and do all sorts of crazy stuff. I know how to meditate like a motherfucker while I'm driving. But every time we come here from the hotel, I submit to Tarek driving. Well, here's what I also know. This Tarek likes to be in control, too. So I let him be in control. And I submit. And I sit. Okay? I have a full awareness of this powerlessness. Now, here's what's really cool. Is when you really get in touch with this powerlessness, you know when you need to call for help. You know when you need to talk to your sponsor or your 10-step buddies, because I'm experiencing this powerlessness in this moment and I can't do anything about it. I prayed and I meditated and it's still here. Or you just pray and meditate and you ask God to remove it, and then get this, God does. Sometimes God doesn't, and it forces us to reach out to others. I'm in the middle of, currently, an experience where my wife is extremely angry with me, and it's really not about me. And conveniently, before we came here, when we got to the hotel yesterday, I got the opportunity to 10-step it with my sponsor. And he asked me an interesting question. He said, does this bother you? And my response was, I don't think so. Because I don't think it's really about me. Okay? But yet, you heard me read multiple times in this inventory that others' behaviors defines me. Right? That one seems to be softening. I can now be okay with somebody not being okay with me as long as I've checked myself, I've 10-stepped it with some other people, and I get to the realization that I don't really think this has anything to do with me. And I can rest in the peace in the presence of God and knowing that there's a purpose and trusting that it's happening for a reason. Back in the days of drinking, I would be drinking at her. I would be trying to fix it. I would be trying to manipulate her to change her mind and not be mad at me by being mad at her and all sorts of other stuff. I am powerless over her. And I don't have to drink or use over that today. We drink and use because we've got to fix something within ourselves that has to do with what's going on outside of ourselves, which reflects inside of ourselves. When I'm at perfect peace and ease, you know what the world looks like? Perfect peace and ease. The world reflects back to me how I am. If I'm all twisted up on the inside, everybody's pissing me off. Everything's wrong. And I've got a drink or use to satisfy whatever that is. The good news is today I don't have to do that. So I'm going to read a little bit out of this thing called Reflections of Step One by a gentleman named Paul F. I'm going to read a little bit of this each time because it's pretty long and I don't want to. I know you guys love it when we read to you for extended periods of time because you pay attention so well and you stay in touch with every word that we're saying because we're so enthralling. My experience and attitude with steps 2 through 12 is simply a reflection of what I experienced in step 1. If I am honest with myself in step one, I cannot escape the truth. I cannot escape the reality that there is nothing I can do to keep myself clean or sober. I will see that I am guaranteed to drink or use again. There is no hope in step one. I will digest the truth that I do not have the power to choose whether or not I will or will not drink or use. Relying on my memory of the suffering keeps me sober, of my suffering to keep me sober is no longer an option. My better judgment and greater intellect will not produce a mental defense against the first drink or drug. As a result of experiencing the first step rather than it being an intellectual exercise, I am in touch with my powerlessness at a gut level. Listen to this. This tends to produce discomfort. This discomfort is a gift. This very gift promotes a desire to seek power, which I do not possess. This discomfort is not to be confused with fear being the motivation to stay clean and sober. To rely on fear to stay sober is dangerous. For the day will come when the fear will disappear, and then there will be no reason for me to stay sober. To be honest, in my first step is to surrender completely. I am surrendering to the fact that I have no power. This surrender is what produces the hope and promises in the remaining steps. Without this surrender, I will not experience an entire psychic change, nor will I experience the many gifts that the big book authors talk about.
Before we take a break, I want to leave you with a thought. Something to consider. Nobody in this room is more or less connected to God than anyone else in this room. I'm no more connected to God today than I was 14 years ago with a crack stem in my mouth. I'm just as close to God today as I was back then. You're never going to be any closer to God than you are in this moment. The only thing that has changed is my awareness of that presence. My awareness of that presence is the only thing that changes. So we're about to start step two when we come back from break, so I wanted to leave you with that. It is 9:55. Let us come back at 10:25. Cool? 10:25. 30-minute break.